Open again.
Oh, I have to open again. Good morning. This is Wednesday, February the 25th. This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I believe that they plan to start on page 37. It looks like this is the last day of the three-day overview. So just turn it over to
Nancy.
Ms. Golden and her crew.
Okay. Welcome once again.
Good morning.
Hear from Mr. Cannon this morning.
Yes, sir.
Co-Chair Monroe and Co-Chair Kamp, for the record, I'm Nancy Golden, the Chief Education Officer. And we're going to begin by, we gave you a folder of the questions you've asked. We have responses for most of those, and we'll get the responses that we don't have. If you look on the left side, that is just we've added on the students organizational chart, just legislators with the governor's name, which was requested. But if we look at the right, we want to start with Oregon's progress towards 40-40-20. There was a question asked yesterday, and we didn't respond as quickly as we wanted to, because it's sort of complex, so we wanted to have it in front of you. So here is the data, and what we want to talk about with this data, so it's this one right here, is that what we're really talking about is when we're measuring, we're really measuring Oregon's economic prosperity. So when you see in the front, what we're measuring is adult attainment between ages of 25 to 65. The legislators actually, in legislation, Oregon legislation around 40-40-20, did define what we were looking at in terms of 40-40-20 was the adult population. So it's very holistic, and it reflects economic attainment so that we can look at the workforce as a whole. So that's what that refers to. What we also know is that the strategic investments that are recommended in the governor's budget for 15-17 represent both short-term and long-term strategies. So short-term would be the things we would do most immediately, like looking at increasing CTE and STEM. Long-term's at third-grade reading. We know third-grade reading is going to make a difference in 40-40-20. It's going to take a little bit longer because we're starting with kids at the age of three to really press on that one. So what you've seen since 2010 is that students have progressed close to the 40-40-20. What's notable is that we've had about a 2 percentage point increase in terms of students moving towards the 40-40-20. And so that's what we have in terms of the data. And I'll just continue to go on. If you look at the next documents, are really research. People asked about research. So this is about the five regional promises. We've heard of Eastern Promise. We're not calling the others Eastern. They're very similar, but they're not the same. So this is the initial research by Education Northwest about that. The next document is the Oregon Mentor Program. And what you'll see in the Mentor Program, because most of these investments have only been out in the field about a year, you'll see mainly it's talking about how many mentors, teachers have been mentored. We don't have data yet on the impact that's had, because it usually takes more than a year. The next piece is on CTE. And I love this piece, because if you look at the back, what you're really going to see, because we've been doing CTE for a while, there is data that really shows the difference if you take only one CTE credit, the difference it can make. So that's what that one's about. And then the very last one, people asked the question about what did we learn from the last biennium that's really going to impact what we do in this biennium. So what you'll see on here is what we learned from the pilots out there, or the grants, the pilots out there from this biennium impacts the recommendation for the next biennium. So that's what one of the elements that led to the age 3 to grade 3 recommendations. What you'll see from the Eastern Promise replication is what's led to accelerated learning recommendations, which is Senate Bill 84 at this point. And also what you'll see about quality, the network of quality of teaching, and the TEL survey has led to the recommendations. So this is what we've learned from the last biennium and how it impacts our recommendations this biennium. So this is information you requested in some form.
Questions?
Chair.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe. Nancy, I'm all about, I love the Oregon Mentoring Program, and it has been in existence since 2007. And so I guess we kind of need to take the fast facts and then combine it with what's on the last page about the Network for Quality Teaching to really get the whole picture, maybe.
Yeah. So Representative Comp, what I hear you saying is before we made the bigger investment, there was already an investment in that, and to add that on so we get the whole picture.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. That's a great suggestion.
Because, yes, our original investment was modest, and last year's was a much bigger improvement.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
Thank you, Representative Comp. I remember back in 07 when Betty and I started working together on this, and that was one of our highest priorities,
yeah,
was getting the mentoring program up to snuff. And yeah, we'd like to know how successful we've been.
Well, Co-Chair.
Go ahead.
I think our first investment was $3 million, and now, like, this biennium, it's appreciably a different number.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So I just want to set the stage for today. We started talking about moving on the three pathways. We talked about the pathway to kindergarten and third grade reading, and now we're going to focus on the pathway to high school and post-secondary completion. As part of that, Ben will bring in the presentation that he was going to do before and enhance it. So I want to talk a little bit about this overall pathway and just say what we know we need to do to get high school completion and post-secondary completion is really to accelerate learning in high school as much as we can, have students have an opportunity to take college classes. We need to make sure students are on track in ninth grade, and we need to make sure that we increase the post-secondary affordability to going into post-secondary. The other thing that we know is that kids need to have English language proficiency by the eighth grade if they're really going to succeed in high school. We start very early with that. We want to make sure they have the credits to go on in ninth grade. The college taking courses in high school need to happen, and the aspiration of knowledge about post-secondary opportunities to increase. Okay, and again, these are what are measured on the Achievement Compact. So if we look at the Achievement Compacts, what we're really talking about is ninth grade on track, high school completion, and post-secondary completion. Those are the measures. So as we look at this pathway for high school and post-secondary, one thing we see is that there's three areas which we have suggested some formula changes, and Rob is going to come up and talk about those.
We'll see you, Ben.
I'll be back.
And Mr. Cannon, this only happened to Rob three times yesterday.
Good morning. Co-chairs Conference Monroe, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. Get myself slightly organized here, I apologize. Talk a little bit about three funding formula change recommendations that we have made and that there is some legislation for in this session. And there are three different ones, one around ELL, one around CTE, and another one around ninth grade on track. So I thought I would start first with the ELL funding formula change, which I think has probably had the most attention as we've talked about these funding formula changes over the course of the session, is likely to continue to get some attention. And one of the things that we did as we put this recommended change together was then bring together a really broad-based set of community members, including people from OEA, Stanford Children, Chalkboard, Oregon Health Foundation, superintendents, COSA, and a number of communities of color from across the state. We had three full-day meetings of about 45 to 50 people each time to talk about this funding formula change to see if we could get to agreement about what this ought to look like. And we actually have gotten to a broad base of agreement, and most recently came up with a proposal that would include six things, and I believe has the support of all the organizations who I just mentioned, which is a really unique and strange event. And I credit Nancy Golden and her excellent facilitation and part of the power of OEIB at doing some of this. So the first recommendation is that we, one, develop a uniform identification coding system for spending on ELL students. One of the things that we've recognized is that while we have a uniform accounting code in education, on this particular thing, people count differently. So one district might say we're going to look at translation services and say any money that we spend on that has to do with ELL, and another district might say that that's not the case. We're going to do translation services, but we're not going to count it in our coding. And so it immediately creates a difference in what percentage of the extra half weight that we spend on ELL students currently is actually being spent on ELL students, which creates lots of discomfort for people. So some districts report they spend as little as 6% of the extra half weight, and others as much as 130% of the extra half weight. And yet we don't know for sure if one district is actually spending more on ELL students than the other. And so we need to bring people together, create a uniform accounting code very specifically around ELL, make sure that what we're counting is precisely accurate, and everyone agrees to come together to do that piece of work. The second part of that then would be a public accounting of what districts actually are spending as the extra half weight. So once we've got that nailed down, then we tell people, and this district spends 47% and this district spends 90%, then it's a very public accounting. And by doing that, the thinking about, we had at one point in time saying we need to demand that 90% of the extra half weight is spent, and that we've backed away from that as one of the recommendations, because once we account for it well and we're public about what districts are actually spending, it reduces some of the debate around that and we'll have a much more accurate picture. So second one is that we are transparent in the reporting. The third one is that we would create approximately a $10 million carve out of the state school fund that would be allocated to accomplish two things, items number 3 and 4 in the recommendations. The first is that we would create a focus and priority school-like support network for districts that currently appear to be doing very poorly with outcomes for ELL students. And so there are some districts that appear to get really great results with ELLs and other districts that seem to get very poor results. And we can look at that and quantify it based on the results that we see. And that for those districts that are not doing well, that we would create a support mechanism where the department, honestly, would come alongside and use what we're calling our focus and priority network. So we currently have a network of schools that we are supporting that are low performing with all students. And it's been really popular with the schools that are receiving the support, mostly, and very popular with superintendents and education advocates. And our results are pretty startling. We had 91 schools when we started this work, and we're predicting that by the end of next year we'll have 75% of schools exit the low performing status, which is really remarkable. And it feels good, honestly, to have people turn and say, we want you to replicate that for something else, and specifically for ELL students, and we just need the resource to do that. And then the second component,
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Saxon, are the designations for those schools from the federal government, or they are definitions for low-performing schools?
Co-Chair Comp, the definition for the schools that are receiving support and focus and priority is a federal definition.
Okay.
But what we would create around ELL is our own state definition. So we would need to bring together this roughly the same group of people and say, here are the data that we see. How would we quantify which schools are low performing with ELLs? And those are the schools then that we would support. But we believe that we can quickly reach a common definition of low performing with ELLs.
Okay, thank you.
And then item number four is that we need to ramp up what we're calling the Oregon English Language Plan. It's a plan that was put together three years ago, out of work that Hillsborough, Beaverton, Salem, Kaiser, Tiger, Tualatin, and Portland and Forest Grove did about what would it take to scale up really good English language practices across the state. And we've worked on that some, but we really haven't had the resource to bring it to fruition, and this would give us the resource to do that. And so advocacy from those groups about this $10 million carve-out, also a surprise for me because some of those very same groups are, you know, blood sworn not to advocate for carve-outs in the state school fund, and yet they are for this one. Item number five would be that the 0.5 weight remains 0.5. And item six would be that for districts that are that districts would provide a progress report and rationale for students who remain in ELL programs beyond the typical number of years to remain in an ELL program, which we've designated for students who come in that are pretty high English language functioning. We call those students a level 3 or 4, that if the student remains in ELL for 4 years after that status, that they would need to provide an explanation as to why for each student. And the same thing for any student who shows up very low functioning in English language acquisition, that they get 7 years, and if they're in the program for more than 7 years, that they would need to explain why and submit that explanation to the State Board of Education. And that would offer us a first blush review over the next 2 years of what that looks like so that we can come back and have some further discussion about any other appropriate actions that we might take around ELL and ELL funding. So that's funding formula change number one.
So what I hear you saying is that some schools are keeping students in ELL too long to get the extra weight, continue to get the extra weighting.
Co-Chair Monroe, yes, in general, that is what I said. I hesitate to say too long, because it is kind of the school's or the school district's responsibility to determine whether or not a student still needs services. What I would say is that the student hasn't gained the English language skills to exit. And the assessment that they take actually tells us where they are, level 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. And what's happening is students get stuck in level 3 or level 4, which tells me that the focus of program to help them exit is what's stuck. Mm-hmm. And so what we're trying to do is figure out how we make sure that we ramp up the kind of program that will help students exit in a reasonable time frame. The claim for additional money and keeping the student in ELL longer is valid because the student hasn't acquired the English language skills that they need to be successful. And so the real problem is having the kind of focus and strong program to help them exit.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Follow up.
Madam Co-Chair.
And is it still the practice that, first of all, if parents, let's say a school has dual language options, but it's still up to the parents to say, I want my child in immersion or dual option, or I want them in a mainstream class?
Co-Chair Kopp, exactly correct.
And so that parent, and follow up?
Go ahead.
So, and I think it's been hard for schools over the years to really help parents understand that they really do have a voice in all this, too.
Co-Chair Kopp, yes. And so the communication with parents is one of the parts of the Oregon English Language Plan that we're trying to scale up with some of these resources.
Right.
It would help with that.
And the last question.
Go ahead.
If I remember right, there was a timeline when parents had to sign off one way or the other. Do you remember? It seemed like it was awfully early in the school year.
Co-Chair Comp, I think that's accurate, but you're starting to get
I'm down in the weeds, yeah.
That would strip my knowledge base.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we had a little bit of a conversation about this on CTE, but it appears to me that we are moving away from a distribution formula specifically to distribute the money to districts, and now we're going to start taking subgroups out of that distribution formula and tracking how the money is actually being spent. So do we expect then for over time that every one of the groups that get additional money will now be tracked, and it'll be new reports from every school district for each one of those subgroups that are getting extra money over time? Because that would concern me with respect to the time, effort, and industry, and it kind of circumvents the original purpose of having a distribution formula.
Co-chairs Compton Monroe, Senator Roblin, I think that's fairly accurate, especially when I begin to talk about the freshman on track and the CTE funding formula change. Around the ELL funding formula change, we would be asking for one additional report. At the same time, there are a number of community advocates in the state of Oregon who are incredibly concerned about the length of time that students stay in ELL programs. Of students who are identified in ELL, roughly 35% are still in ELL programs in their senior year of high school. And so it is, and some who have been in since kindergarten and are senior in high school. And so it's a real concern on the part of the communities, and what they're asking is, why aren't our children getting what they need to be able to speak English to the level that would allow them to access all the knowledge that teachers teach in their classrooms on a daily basis? And shouldn't you be telling us why it is that they still need to remain in an ELL program when they've had 4 years or 7 years respectively, depending on how they entered, and they still are in English language? We're not asking you to reduce funding. We're not asking you to spend more money than you used to spend. We just want to know why this student hasn't exited in 7 years. I mean, what's the rationale for that? And if you can tell us why that is, and we can collect that on a statewide basis, that perhaps we can figure out what the issue is and begin to address it in a better way. Or we can think about whether or not there needs to be a different way that we think about how funding is being distributed that would encourage a more rapid exit.
Go ahead.
So we have other ways of funding special programs other than the formula. We've had a fund out there for a long time that we could put money in and have those same expectations and do it differently, because I get concerned we're going to be asking, if we go down this path, my belief is that then we'll be asking, why are we getting extra money for poverty when they've been in the school system for X number of years? Why haven't we helped exit that? Why are we keeping kids in special education for periods of time longer than we think they should have been able to exit special education programs? Why would we not have the same kind of issue over time, and the next level of state request for new issues? That's a concern that I have with regard to mixing the formulas.
Co-chairs Compton Monroe, Senator Roblin, really good points. I guess I would have to say that it's really hard for the school to fix whether or not a family is in poverty. I think that's a really super challenge. And then the other part around special ed identification is that really, if special ed identification is done appropriately, the student should never exit special ed status. And it's because if I have a learning disability, I really have it. And there's nothing that you can do that's going to fix my learning disability. You might approach my learning methodology in a way that helps me learn a lot, that addresses my issue so that I can learn everything that everybody else can learn. But ELL is not that way. Students show up and they have a challenge in accessing content to knowledge. A teacher's talking to them, but they don't understand what they're saying, and they're not learning math and social studies. And that is completely overcomable by all students, that they can learn to speak English and they can learn to speak it to an academic level so that they can access the content that's being taught in class. And that there ought to be a time frame upon which a student ought to be able to accomplish that.
Okay.
Two other ones, and these are a little bit different. So what I talked about just a second ago is a little different way of thinking about ELL and the idea of a carve-out to help support the English language plan and schools that are low performing with ELL students. What I'm going to talk about now around ninth grade on track and CTE is a really different thinking. And I've tried to think a lot about sort of what the issue is here a little bit. And honestly, I think I would lay the issue to some degree about the up and down funding structure that we have sometimes in education in the state, where, you know, we suffered through two recessions, one in 2002 and then one in 2007, that changed school districts' funding levels in mid-biennium at times, and districts were left to reduce program. And a lot of times the program that they reduced were those that were expensive or seemed extra. So a couple of those would be CTE programs, which are more expensive to run than other kinds of programs because of the equipment and the numbers of kids and safety and the materials that need to be used, like metal and wood and cars and so forth. And or extra programs like support for students that are struggling. And that when we when money is reduced a little bit, sometimes those are the first programs that get reduced. And what we're trying to do here is design something within the funding formula that would have us retain those programs and support them even when dollars get tough, because it would behoove the district to actually allocate resource to these particular efforts. So the idea around ninth grade on track, and I'll start with that one just because it's an easier one to explain, is that we know that when students are on track at the end of ninth grade, that they're much more likely to graduate on time. And on track for us means that they've earned 6 credits, there are 24 credits to graduate, so they're a fourth of the way, and that they also are attending the majority of the time, 90% of the time. And that when students do that, they're highly likely to graduate. In fact, the attendance piece is the highest predictor of on-time graduation. And that in order to do that, there are some programs that can be implemented that really support it. And especially if we targeted these resources to students who typically have been underserved, so students in poverty, special ed, ELL, and students of color, which is how this formula works, that when a student is given additional services via a summer school and support over the course of the school year, and they earn 6 credits at the end of their freshman year, and they've attended 90% of the time, that there is an additional funding factor that goes to the district for having accomplished that. And that funding factor is a 0.05. It's approximately $400. The methodology to come up with this 0.05, I want to make sure I had the right number right, the methodology to come up with that is a calculation of what it actually costs to offer summer school to 100 students and or to offer the support programs over the course of the year around attendance. And if you worked the math, you would find out that it costs about $400 to offer a student those kinds of services over the course of a year. And that if a district did offer those services and the student accomplished what we hope that they would accomplish, 6 credits, and they're attending regularly, that at the end of the year, because the district has supported that, they would quasi, I guess, be reimbursed for having provided those services and accomplished what we hope that they would accomplish. And so that's how that's been thought about and designed. I'm sure that there'll be some questions about the idea of that. I will tell you that the way that we typically, or the way that we do release the state school funding formula, would actually give the district the money up front and not backload it. Because what we ask districts to do is project how many students they're going to have in any given school year. And so if a district were to project that they were going to have 100 students accomplish this, and it's 0.05, they actually would say that they're going to have an additional 5 students in their ADMW over the year, and they would tell the state that, and we would give them the money for that up front. They would conduct the program, and so they would have it to offer the kind of summer school and support program over the course of the year. And then there is a settling up after about a year and a half that we do on how many students a district actually did have that sort of makes the numbers correct, so that districts can't tell us they're going to have more and then not actually have the students show up and keep the money forever. So that technically is how that works.
That's really critical. I remember when I was on the David Douglas School Board, we raised our graduation requirements to the highest in the state. They had to make a C or better in their core classes, and there were several other requirements that made us the highest in the state. And we were told, well, you're just going to have your graduation rate's going to drop dramatically because your standards are so high. But we also included Saturday programs, after school programs, summer school programs, all kinds of opportunities for students that were behind somewhere to get caught up. And our graduation rate did not fall. In fact, it increased. So I hear what you're saying, and it works. And we need to make it universal for the entire state.
Thank you, Coach Monroe. Yes. So the CTE funding formula is not dissimilar to what I just described. It is that CTE programs are expensive to operate. We'd like to see lots of students come through with CTE credits and what that can lead to for us in the state. And so this formula change would, again, target underserved populations. And if students earned 3 credits in a single CTE strand area, so the medical field, for example, or welding, as another example, then the district would receive an additional 0.1 ADMW. If the student, that's for all students. If the student was underserved, it would be another 0.1. And if the student actually earned an industry credential over the time that they were in the school system, so they earn a certificate for programming or a work certificate, or a work certificate for welding and so forth that says I have a skill, there would be an additional 0.1 for a total possible of 0.3 for students. That is, an additional 0.3 is about $2,100.
Senator Thompson,
is that enough for a school to set up a welding class program?
Co-chairs Conference Row, Senator Thompson, thank you for the question. Really interesting question. When I talk to CTE teachers and superintendents, they tell me yes. The setup of the program is expensive in its initial program. Later today, you're going to hear me talk about some money for CTE to do startup programs. And so starting up the program is one thing. We've spent about $11.5 million a biennia, the last 2 biennia for that. We're going to make that request again this year. So we have all this revitalization of CTE programs, but they're expensive to run. My fear is that in the next economic downturn, it's an expensive program to run, and it gets cut. And this is a way to create a funding stream that allows for CTE programs that are created to continue, because it's smart. It's smart business on the part of the district to continue to offer CTE because it brings in additional revenue. This revenue stream is a healthy revenue stream for CTE programs that are developed to continue to operate.
You bet. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chairman Rao. I actually had the same question as Senator Thompson, but I also wanted to know, so is the idea that every high school in the state is going to be offering CTE?
Co-chairs Compton Rao, Representative Taylor, no.
Okay.
Not every high school in the state does offer CTE. Were I a superintendent and didn't have a CTE program and this formula change happened, I would immediately make sure that my high schools had CTE programs. And that is part of what we're after.
We have a radio program.
And so those schools and districts that offer CTE programs actually would receive additional revenue for delivering CTE and getting CTE outcomes to students. And those who didn't would receive less, because this is a cost-neutral proposal. There's no additional money that we're asking for to do this. It's a redistribution of resource based on who actually accomplishes it.
Follow-up?
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm concerned about students in high school not having their senior year fully funded. Okay, so right now we have a problem in the state of Oregon where we have students that in their senior year we don't fully fund their senior year of high school. I don't know if that's across the board, but I know in Portland Public Schools that's definitely the case. And although I think CTE sounds great and there's all sorts of evidence showing the merits of that, since we have a set budget and we're going to be making, you know, we're considering this adjustment, you probably know where I'm going with this, but so, and then we're going to allow, if I hear you correctly, allowing the school districts, just want you to confirm if I'm saying this correctly. So the school districts will be able to decide if they want to have a CTE program, but yet they still will not be offering, may not be able to offer a full senior year of high school. I'm trying to understand how this is going to work. Maybe you could clarify, shed some light onto what I see as a potential problem. So, please.
Co-chairs Compton Rowe, Representative Taylor. I don't know if I can adequately probably answer your question.
Okay.
Because it's very complex. There are lots of high schools in the state that offer full schedules to students all the time on the resource base that we have. And then there are some districts that don't. And there's so many choices that are inherent on that are around local control that I don't know how to address that necessarily. But it is a local control issue. The districts decide how they're going to allocate their resources at elementary, middle, and high. The difference on this particular model is that it would offer additional resource for districts that offered and were successful in having students earn CTE credits. I know that's not a great answer, but the sort of vagaries of local decision making are really hard to account for specifically.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. So we could have a scenario where we change the formula in a school district because they decide they want to have CTE offered. They could go ahead and start that program and not offer a full senior year of high school courses. Mm-hmm. Could that end up happening?
Co-chairs Monroe and Comp, Representative Taylor, yes, it could end up happening, but I would make the argument that because CTE is pretty high school specific in this particular funding formula change, that it actually has the potential to offer additional classes at the high school level, which would fill out which would, I hope, excite students about some opportunities and fill their schedule out. I know that we often look at our own children. My own son, who was not necessarily a CTE student, loved the CTE programs in the school that he went to, and it helped make his junior and senior years really robust when he was like a kind of a academic egghead.
Mm-hmm.
But he loved it.
Thank you.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rob, was the term underserved? Isn't that the term you were using? How is that defined?
Yes, Co-Chairs Compton Monroe, Representative Huffman. In this instance, we're defining it as students in poverty, students of color, ELL, and special education. It accounts for about 61% of students in the state.
Go ahead.
Kind of a follow-up thought, I guess. I don't know, because I've mulled this over, and I think a few of us on the panel have to deal with rural issues, part of that being poverty and other things you mentioned. Just trying to I'm always battling with trying to figure out through the equity lens and the underserved and defining really underserved and how that can serve to benefit really struggling rural districts. So that's why I was asking.
And Co-Chairs Compton Monroe, Representative Huffman, the percentages of poverty students in rural Oregon are really high. And I do think that the inclusion of poverty within this calculation really supports rural districts.
Okay. Go ahead. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Just a very quick one. We had this conversation before, and I really love CTE. I think they keep kids in school. I think they are really great for those underserved populations because they offer them something that's different. I, again, have a concern about formula use, just because now this one we aren't expecting a report like we were in the ELL. So superintendents can encourage their people to put CTE programs in and then spend the money any way they want. So they could use it to help other full-time programs. So there's no tracking of how it's being spent. It's just an extra formula addition. And that makes me nervous, and I think there might be other ways if we whether want to encourage CTE to fund it. But the fact that we have CTE programs, and many of our rural areas, we have not lost them. I mean, the districts have made a priority to keep those programs, and this will give them some additional money that they can maybe do some other things with, and I would expect that they will go to supporting their CTE programs. I worry about how it's being done, and down the road, people are going to say, well, we're not tracking that, so we need to track how that money is being spent, and all of a sudden we have a distribution formula that's no longer a distribution formula. That has me concerned, and we had that conversation before, so
yes.
Just wanted to make it on the record.
Thank you.
So the next thing we want to talk about to be successful in this pathway to high school and post-secondary completion is the quality teaching and learning network. And what we know is there's no factor more important than a quality teacher in front of every student. That's a 20 times more influential than anything else we do. And I see all the teachers shaking their heads because we know that. In addition to that, we know that if the faces of the staff reflect the faces of the students, it makes a huge difference. I have to say, as a superintendent with a growing Latino population, when we hired a principal who could speak Spanish and make sure that the culture of the Latino children were reflected in the school, it really made a huge difference. So we know that that's really important, which really has to do with recruitment and retention of teachers and administrators of color. And then we also know that there's these other factors for quality teaching and learning, which this investment really is for. And those are for supporting collaborative time. That's very important. It's also for a practice of making sure we have regional coaches who can work with our teachers. It's to ensure we have mentorship programs, not only for teachers, but new administrators, to provide online access to collaborative spaces. So ODE did hire one of the nationally best-known people on online learning. Sarah is just amazing. So you can do a lot of collaboration online if it's done correctly. And then we also know to really close the opportunity gap, we have to be culturally responsive. And we really have to learn what that means, and we also need to make sure that we do diversify the workforce. So being culturally responsive are things like when students read books, they see books that reflect their cultures, not just one culture. So those are all the things we need to do to make sure we have quality teaching and learning for our students. So with that, we're going to have Ben come up.
Mr. Chair, just a reality check. We have about 35, 40 minutes left to complete the entire presentation.
Can I just make a comment?
That's because we ask too many questions.
Can I make a comment?
No,
Senator
we don't.
Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to make a comment because a couple days ago I actually put our Rob on the spot about having professional people in the department that could be helpful to others, and he mentioned that he had that has been changing the last couple of years since I've been out of the education. I had the opportunity to talk to a number of superintendents the other day, and they confirmed that it has been really outstanding improvements in the last 2 years. So I want to make sure that I acknowledge that because that was really good information for me to hear. So thank you very much.
Me too. Thank you.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you. I just wanted to check in on the time front. We did not get all the way through the early learning stuff yesterday. So is the plan to go back to that on another day, later today?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure exactly what their plan is, but I do remind you right after this presentation starting Monday, we'll dive into more detail with the Department of Education's budget, where I'm sure they can incorporate or make up some of that information.
Our intention was to finish this first and then have them come back up, but the questions are important. They're just making it so that we might need to catch up on Monday, but we'll make sure we do.
Mr. Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Becky
remember
Cannon.
When his hair was all black?
And not that long ago.
Be hard on him.
And I remember.
And he was a teacher.
No, he was a young, good-looking teacher, and now he's looking like a middle-aged man, I'll tell you.
That's gracious. What an introduction. Welcome.
I'm glad I'm not testifying.
I'm very glad to be here this morning. Really. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for our Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And one of the challenges of working on higher education in a P20 system is that we tend to go last, not because of any sort of sense of priority, but just because we're last in the continuum. The good news is that being in that position repeatedly makes me good at being brief. And so I will move quite quickly through a short set of slides, knowing that we'll have ample time with this committee when we get into the higher education budgets in a few weeks. I do want to just on sort of coming back to 40-40-20 just for a moment, and And I think helping to reflect the sense of priority that the state has around, and that Nancy and the others on the team have around higher education. As Nancy described, that goal in statute is a goal for our adult population. And we talked about our progress on that working age population of 25 to 64 year olds. It's also a goal for the year 2025. And if you think about it, 25 to 64 year olds in 2025 are aged 15 to 54 today. That's who we're formally, officially focused on. Now, higher education clearly has a big part of the lift to reach to those 15 to 54 year olds today and help support them in the training, the education, the credentials that will support their economic and other goals. I'm going to just touch on one of the commission's and the OEIB's primary recommendations relative to investments in higher education, and it really is an affordability approach. And we've taken on affordability because we understand, I think all of us, that it represents one of the biggest barriers to our achievement goals. We have, at the same time, though, understood that affordability is not identical to tuition. It can't be understood in tuition terms alone. Tuition is a significant part of the equation, but not the only part of the equation for understanding higher affordability within higher education. And so what is described on this slide is really a multifaceted and integrated approach to affordability that we've brought forward in our budget recommendations. The first one really targets what students pay, and it is through the expansion of our Oregon Opportunity Grant, our state's need-based aid program. That recommendation came from the governor to you, and the co-chair's framework is likewise brings forward the notion of expanding our state investment in need-based aid. The commission also has recommendations for redesigning how that aid is allocated to students and focusing on the highest need students, using that methodology to help refine how we allocate the grant.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ben, in the work group that was put together looking at the opportunity grant, what did we come up with in tracking those to our 40-40-20 goal of attaching that with degree completion? Because we hadn't been tracking that in 2013. That was kind of uncovered, and a work group got together to look at it.
Representative Huffman, Chair Monroe, thanks for the question. And actually, it was those conversations in 2013 with you in particular, Representative, that helped spur the creation of a work group that ultimately produced the recommendations that we're bringing to the legislature in a policy bill, as well as in our related funding request for the Opportunity Grant. In a nutshell, yes, we have more clearly today we can more clearly today understand the impact of the Opportunity Grant on completion. We can connect Opportunity Grant recipients with completion-related data. And in our recommendations, we are proposing to allocate some of the money partly in order to incentivize persistence and completion, which is not something that we've done before. And we would be happy to go more in depth about those particular recommendations. We have a bill, House Bill 2407, that is in the House Higher Education Committee now that contains that work. And presumably that could end up here for your consideration as well.
Thank you.
Okay.
In addition to our recommendations on the state need-based aid program, the Opportunity Grant, we also recommend increasing institutional funding and allocating those dollars through the commission in ways that support colleges and universities in their goal to impact student success. Today, we have an enrollment-based allocation methodology that creates every incentive for institutions to enroll students, and they do that admirably. And our work at the commission level, and it's reflected in the recommendations of the OEIB, has been to help shape or shift some of that funding to support institutions in student success and efforts towards completion. The final point here relates to really post-secondary access, guidance, and support for reaching college and succeeding in college. Our budget recommendations contain an emphasis on our Aspire program, that is administered through the Office of Student Access and Completion of the HAC, and other mechanisms to invest in students and families and support for planning for post-secondary success. If we were operating in a PowerPoint environment rather than a Internet Explorer one, we would have an animated series of slides. I don't think that's going to work on the internet-based version. That's okay. Many of you have seen versions of these before, and you will again, most likely. And we covered much of the structural changes that have affected higher education over the last couple of years early on in the presentation. When you saw, back on Monday, you saw the larger P20 chart. So what you're actually looking at on the screen now is, you should basically ignore, because it's partway through what is actually an animated series of slides that shows how our post-secondary structure has changed between since 2013. In a nutshell, we've gone from having four boards in the business of regulating and supporting higher education to one, the HAC, guided by the OEIB. So you could really say 5-2. We've called this 4-1. You could say 5-2. We've merged the responsibilities from community colleges that were at the Board of Education to the HAC. We've shifted from a State Board of Higher Education, a governing board for our public universities, to a coordinating board, the HAC. OSAC's board has been eliminated, and its responsibilities have been shifted to the HAC. So we're able to bring forward through the HAC and the OEIB a set of recommendations that reflects a comprehensive approach to higher education, gets the commission involved and the OEIB in the very difficult questions that ultimately you have to wrestle with about priority setting within higher education, the conversations that nobody really wants to have because they're very, very difficult, but we're having them in one setting now. We have we're in the process of creating a single post-secondary education. The HEC staff that I lead that supports this work and supports you in the policy efforts. And in doing so, we're integrating agencies, reducing silos, finding efficiencies, and attempting to free up resources for where they really belong, which is in the teaching and learning that occurs through our colleges, universities, and other post-secondary institutions.
Mr. Cannon, a few years ago, I was told that the chances of our high school graduates from east of the Cascades, their chances of going to college are about half for those that grew up west of the Cascades. I wondered if that's still the case, if that is changing. That was a discussion we were having about whether or not to close Eastern Oregon, and I was fighting against that, and whether or not to maintain the Cascade campus and Bend and so on to provide those opportunities. I remember the discussion being that these kids that grew up in rural Eastern Oregon were not very likely to want to travel to Oregon State or Oregon or Portland State to go to higher, get their higher education, and that they generally came from families where mom and dad had not gone to college and so on. And there were various reasons why, but this was a fact that if you graduate from high school in Eastern Oregon, you were less than half as good a chance of going to college than Western Oregon. Do you know if that's still the case? Do you know if that gap is shrinking or growing? Because it's of great concern to me. I've always preached that Oregon is one state, that what's good east of the mountains is good west of the mountains and vice versa, that we need to think of Oregon as one state, not as rural and urban. And when we meet the needs of all of the people of the state of Oregon, the whole state is better off. Anyway.
Mr. Chair, it's a really good question, and I would like to get back to you with the precise data. I will say this. Geographic proximity to a college or university matters, and it does expand access. There's no question. part of that is because it expands affordability. Again, if you think of affordability as, or cost as including not just tuition, but living costs, one way that students reduce living costs is by living sharing space with family, right? Living at home if they're a younger student. We think relying more on their parents or other family members for support. That's much harder to do if you're traveling great distances for college. So it, I think it, it is the case that proximity matters. It's also the case that our poverty rates matter, and we know that those aren't experienced identically around the state. We do have data, and I can be rather precise about this by memory. Students of equal ability, as measured by high school achievement tests. Now, take those with whatever grain of salt you think they warrant. But nevertheless, students with roughly equal abilities graduate at vastly different rates depending on whether they qualified for free and reduced lunch or not, and graduate college, earn college degrees at very different rates, about twice as likely with the same math score on an Oaks test in 2004. They're about twice as likely to have earned a college BA anywhere in the country if they were not free and reduced lunch than if they are. So we also know the impact that poverty makes. Geographic proximity is something I'll have to look at more, but I have no doubt that it has a significant impact.
Okay.
Final comments from me, just relative to coming back to the sort of recommendations around affordability. Oops, I think I've skimmed through it. One more. So I mentioned at the outset our recommendations on the opportunity grant, a little bit more specific here in terms of the roughly 25% increase that we're proposing and touching on the redesign. Again, much more to say about that in the context of House Bill 2407. And a note here about the way in which bringing those that investment up to over $140 million will expand the number of students who are able to serve, who will target the grant to focus on those who have the greatest financial need and who are progressing academically, and will improve predictability in the program, which today is a bit of a scattershot in terms of who gets it from year to year. And finally, just to sort of foreshadow some of the discussions we'll continue to have with this committee when we think about affordability and not just tuition, obviously cost of living, transportation, textbooks, fees, et cetera. Affordability also can and should be understood in terms of a student's likelihood of succeeding and completing a degree. A program may be relatively high cost to the student, but if they complete it and they get a good job, it may well have been worth the investment. And more often than not, I think we would say that higher education, even at the greater costs students are bearing today, is a great investment when you complete. The corollary, of course, is that if a student starts, incurs those costs, doesn't succeed, even if those costs were quite modest, it probably doesn't pay off as an investment. So understanding affordability, not only in terms of tuition, living costs, but also success, completion, and importantly, time to completion, is, we believe, a big part of the equation. And the budget that we'll describe to you reflects, in part, that emphasis.
And yet, we still pay, reimburse community colleges, for example, by FTE with no differentiation between those high-cost programs that lead to good-paying jobs and those less expensive programs. I mean, you get the same FTE. And so Mount Hood Community College, with wonderful facilities for training medical students, have to turn away about 4 out of every 5 that apply because they simply don't get reimbursed at a high enough rate to cover those increased costs. So that's a problem I've been thinking a lot about lately, and I want us to look at when we try to determine how best to compensate our institutions, our community colleges, our universities for the various types of students and the various success rates. Every student that gets accepted to a medical, dental hygienist, or whatever medical program at Mount Hood Community College, when they graduate, they have a good paying job, guaranteed. And yet, so many of them get turned away.
And Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, we really look forward to describing our thinking along those lines, which I think shares a lot with the points that you've made. And there is work underway that we talked to Doug about bringing to this committee that I think will begin to address the point that you're making.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. The is it true that the number of remedial classes being taught at least six of our public universities, I'm not sure if they have remedial classes at OIT, maybe they do, is it true that the number of remedial classes being taught to students is increasing?
Representative Taylor, Mr. Co-Chair, I don't know whether it is or not. I do know that remedial education is a major feature of what we do in higher education, especially at community colleges, although also, as you note, to some extent at universities. That is true in Oregon, and it's true nationally. I don't know how what the trend looks like specifically at our public universities, but would be happy to find out.
Follow-up?
Go ahead.
It's my understanding that the number of students needing to take remedial classes is increasing quite a bit. That's my understanding. You can confirm that. And I understand that the students, of course, have to pay for those classes, and those are very expensive classes, and they don't get college credit for those, which is, you know, makes sense. They need to be paid a teacher. And I support the idea of having a seamless system that you're trying to create, and you have quite the challenge ahead of you. But the reason I bring it up is because it seems that we have an enormous amount of evidence at the end. We can see where students were prepared and not prepared. And my understanding is that the data is there to show where these students went to high school, for example, that take the remedial classes. So the reason I'm bringing this up is that it seems like a good idea to look back and see the students that are taking remedial classes. It's great that they got to college, but if they take remedial classes, I'll go ahead and make the bet that it's unlikely that they're gonna graduate from college. So I'm a little bit worried that we're taking these students' money. They're borrowing the money. It's contributing to their student debt. They're not getting college credit for it. And they weren't taught in high school for whatever reasons, or they didn't master it in high school. Maybe they were taught it, but they didn't master the subject. And it's kind of pushing the problem along. And I know none of you are supportive of it, that concept. I can't imagine that any of you are supportive of that. And you would probably recognize that that's a problem. But I was just wondering if any or all of you could speak to how we could address this what I know to be a problem.
Yeah, Representative Taylor, Mr. Co-Chair, Rob and Nancy may want to chime in as well. I, first of all, really appreciate and endorse the attention that your question brings to the issue of remedial education. It is...
At the university level, which is an oxymoron to me. But.
Right. At the university and community college level, just to be clear, that's far and away where we do the most remedial education. It's with students, some of whom have graduated recently from high school, some of whom graduated many years ago from high school, but they're showing up at community colleges or universities, and they are being assessed in writing and math, and as a result of those assessments, they're being placed in, as you know, pre-college level courses for which they're not earning college credit. That is a significant challenge for those students, a significant barrier to achieving 40-40-20, and a significant point of focus for the OEIB, for the HEC, and the Department of Education. I'll mention a couple of things that are underway to try to get at that, and then, as I said, Nancy or Rob may want to add on. One is the question of placement, or the issue of placement in remedial education. So quite typically, a student shows up at a university or a community college in the fall and takes a standardized test on material that they may not have studied, seen for months or years. And naturally, you know, they may not do very well, and they're placed into a course that they took maybe months earlier, it may have been years earlier. And what our colleges and universities are increasingly doing, some with support from the state, because we've put some dollars into this, is redesigning how they are assessing and how they are supporting students in brushing up on those skills, you know, a sort of crash course before the assessment test, for example, that some of our colleges are offering to students so they get to brush up before they're forced to take that placement test. Some of it is about serving those students after they have been appropriately placed into a remedial ed course. Another effort related to assessment is to say, look, if a student graduated recently from high school and they passed that Smarter Balanced, which it will be, test in the subject area, and we're convinced, as we are, that that Smarter Balanced test represents college readiness, that's the point, then using that to stand for placement, rather than providing them a different test, giving them a different test the day they show up at the community college or university. At least six of our seven universities have committed to using Smarter Balance for placement purposes for recent high school graduates. It's not going to work for somebody who graduated 5 years ago, of course, but for upcoming high school graduates. And that, too, we think will help smooth this path between high school and college. Even more fundamentally, speaking of smoothing the path, and it's actually alluded to on this slide, and Rob may speak to it, is the idea that what we're teaching and requiring from high school students ought to be, at least in those core subject areas, aligned with what we're expecting students in basic college level writing and math courses to know and be able to do. Yeah. And there is mismatch today. It's not as aligned as it ought to be.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have two things. Dr. Roselli and I have been working on this issue for a while. We have a bill that is creating a task force on this exact topic. And the other irony of some of this is Chemeketa might use a certain RIT score or a scale score on their placement tests, and PCC will use a whole different RIT score. So there's a lot of variables that are happening, and hopefully the one that Ben is talking about, that there will be, well, we have a task force that, if the bill passes, that they'll look at such things as using the Smarter Balance or the student's transcript a lot more closely to see what their potential is and what they have, what they've done in their high school classes. So, and I just wanted to, this is just kind of a fly on the wall comment. I have been told recently that our universities, in particular not our community colleges, are not smoke free. I would like to hear some verification of that. And for all of us in Oregon that get a little fanatical about our environment and our expectations for our public buildings, not a big deal, but I would hope that our campuses are smoke-free. I mean, we now have police at the football games, so I mean, we can do a few things.
Senator Monroe, follow up. I just wanted to clarify that regarding the remedial classes, I guess I'm more focused on the students that just graduated from high school. I understand when people go back to school, but it makes a lot more sense, at least to me it makes more sense, that if you are an adult and you want to go back to school and you're going to one of the universities, and if there is a community college accessible, that I would like to think that our universities are advising them to go to the community college to take the class for less money instead of taking it at the university. That was the seamlessness that Ms. Golden and I were discussing yesterday, which sounds like a great idea, but one of that is looking back and seeing that the students who just graduated from high school, if they show up in college and have to take remedial classes, that's the area that I was trying to focus on. So,
one of the beauties, I think, of the next thing we're going to talk about, which is accelerated learning, is in order to provide accelerated learning, you do have high school teachers getting together with post-secondary teachers to really talk about what are the competencies, what are the outcomes, what are the skills students need to make sure when you do that transition from 11 through 14, it will end up in kids going into credit-bearing courses and not have to end up in remedial courses. So that's, I think, one of the really good things about it. We do have a handout for you on accelerated learning. Basically, what we're saying, and Representative Huffman was a member of this legislatively appointed committee that met for about a year. And the goal in the Achievement Compact is to have three college courses in high school so kids can taste it, experience, so there can be alignment of what are the standards students need to meet. So what our investment is about here is that cross-sector collaboration to make sure when you take a college course in high school, it's at the college level. And what also is part of it is to build that college-going culture for students who might not have those in their family so they can see, I can go to college. And, of course, the other thing that we really want to do is make sure the way we get this cross K-12, post-secondary collaboration is really having people work in learning communities, I think, to really get at the issues that Representative Taylor is talking about. How do we make this seamless? And the second part of that is make sure we have the math and English redesign where there is that standard alignment, which Rob's going to talk about.
So, story. People of Tillamook County got together and they raised money to create a scholarship for students coming out of Tillamook County and attending Tillamook Community College. And if you had a 3.0 GPA and you showed up and you were able to pass the placement exams into credit-bearing courses, you got your first year of tuition for free at Tillamook Community College. And they couldn't get enough students to pass the entrance exams to spend down the money.
Wow.
And they had a problem. So the superintendent of Tillamook School District and the president of the community college got together, and then they got together the teachers of math and English at both of their institutions, and they said, what's the problem? And they began to look at the Compass exam, which is the placement exam. And they identified some areas on the Compass exam that teachers in the high school weren't teaching in math and English. And they began to align their curriculum, and they're now spending that money wildly and, in fact, have doubled the rates at which students are able to show up and pass that exam so that they can have their first year of tuition for free. And they're making good use of their community resource, and they're graduating kids from their community college at rates that they haven't previously seen. It is the kind of success story that we're looking for through OEIB to say there's a place that it works. If we had a $2 million investment, we can make that happen all across the state. That's what math and English redesign is about, is getting together the college professors and the high school teachers and saying, we've got a set of Common Core standards. What's your standard? What assessment are you using? Now let's make some sense out of this so that we can alter the instruction and make sure that kids are going to show up and demonstrate what they know and what they can do, and they can be in college-bearing courses, and they can make their money go to work for them and for the state of Oregon.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Nancy, Ben, for the example. And you don't need a PhD to figure out alignment. It's common sense. It's getting the people in the room saying, why aren't we aligned? Tillamook did it. It needs to be done statewide. Thank you.
Co-chairs, Representative Huffman, the thing that I want to make sure and emphasize here is OEIB can do that. They're the only convening body that can do that for us. And so when we talk about OEIB during this session, that's how important it is. We get it done or we don't. And OEIB is the place where that happens.
Senator Roblin.
And one of the other issues that we have to address at the senior level of high school is that an awful lot of our students have not had a math class when they graduate for 2 years. So mm-hmm. So they're walking in to take a Compass test having not had a math class for 2 years. That makes it more likely that they're not going to do well on that Compass test.
Very
Senator
true.
Senator Thompson.
Oh, I was just going to echo Rep. Huffman that makes too much sense. I don't know if it'll fly in this building.
Oh, what a cynic.
The last pathway we want to spend just a little bit of time on is connecting education to careers. And what that's really about is that we always are looking forward to see what are the careers out there that we need to be making sure our students are trained for. It's also about how do we create the next careers out there. So sometimes when you think of STEM, right now we're not getting necessarily STEM businesses to come to Oregon because we haven't done the training for our students to really qualify for STEM. So it's not only looking at what are the jobs, it's creating the new jobs in a way that we could all prosper, really raising the level of opportunities for our students. So that's what we're looking at on the pathway. And on the achievement compacts, it's talking about the things that really lead up to this, and we call these more of the short term, are the ninth grade on the track, the high school completion, the post-secondary completion, and post-secondary STEM completion. Now, what we're really trying to do is make sure we have a smooth pathway between CTE, career technical education, and STEM. We know many of our students will leave high school and go straight into some of the CTE courses. They might get a license. They might become a welder. We want them to have the basic skills so when they want to go on, if they choose to a STEM career, they also have that. So we are looking at what do we need to do to get you right into the workforce? What do we need to do to get you to community college where you can go and then go into CTE? And then how, if you want to, can you go into a STEM career? Jim Pyro, who's the head of PG&E, is a perfect example. He started in technical education and after that continued his education, I think became an engineer, and now he's the head of PG&E. So it's certainly a great place to start. We know many, many of our students need to work right after high school or shortly after high school. So we want it to be a seamless pathway, and that's what we're trying to create in our investments in that area.
My neighbor and my son's CTE teacher is out in the lobby today, and if you stop in, he'll have his students scan your head, and they'll make you a bobblehead doll on a 3D printer. Just want you to know that.
No, thank you.
I'll tell you, I tried that, and I broke the machine.
I can't wait.
So be a little careful.
So sometimes we talk about things that we're doing to help students get through school, and it makes it sound like we have to push them through. And when we start talking about CTE and STEM, we're really talking about programs oftentimes that pull kids through. Because kids start to look at this hands-on, a different style of learning, and the things that they can do, and they start to imagine who they're going to be when they're 25 years old and what their life is going to be like that they can create for themselves. And they get excited about the possibilities. And it is a different kind of drive that we create with really robust STEM and CTE programs. Unfortunately, we have disinvested in STEM and CTE right at a time when their importance has really kind of doubled, and where we have a need to make sure that students understand the importance in kind of an age where we really talk about individualized education, and I want things specifically for me. And it's hard to deliver that in some of our typical kinds of courses, but not in STEM and CTE. We also have a huge demand. In fact, the jobs in CTE and STEM grow at 2 to 3 times the rate of other job categories in the state of Oregon. So engineers, medical professionals, high technology, natural resources, manufacturing, all STEM. And in CTE, health sciences, welders, builders, construction trades, industrial engineering systems, automotive trades, and so forth. And our current skills gap in these areas are costly to the economy, the education system, and to the individuals who are in our system that we aren't able to offer these the way that we should. And so part of it is that they're expensive and they require educators with a special skill set to have them teach at a high level. And the real need, if you're going to do it well, to form partnerships with industry. So they require special care, and they're unique when compared to the general education system. They also require special attention if we hope to bring them on track for students for the needs of industry and the health of the economy in our state. So we're asking for specific investments that will make this happen, and that's what this STEM and CTE investments are about. For the past 2 biennia, we've had CTE revitalization and innovation grants, and in 2013-15, the budget provided $11.5 million for the program, and in the last biennia, we had $21.6 million in requests for these revitalization efforts and 62 different applicants. We awarded the $11.5 million that we did have to 32 applicants involving 60 high schools, and they had a combined 338 industry partners and labor partners in their applications that are involved now in these processes out there giving kids really cool experiences. And so the benefits of CTE and STEM are really startling. Our four-year cohort graduation rate for students in 2013 was 68.7%, statewide, 68.7%. For students with a CTE concentration, three or more CTE credits, it was 85.7%.
Yeah.
68 versus 85.7. Even better, our success with students of color. African-American students, 86% four-year cohort graduation rate compared to 57% for African-American students statewide. 82% for Native American compared to 51.7. And Hispanic students, an 84.7% graduation rate compared to 60.8. These programs pull kids through high school, and the differences are remarkable. We're seeking an investment of CTE that I think is a great investment of $24 million. It includes a repeat of the $11.5 million CTE revitalization, $5 million for high-wage, high-demand career pathway collaborations regionally, and $7.5 million for regional access to underserved students to state-of-the-art facilities through summer programs. So a kid who lives in John Day can go up to the community college over the summer in Hood River and take the kinds of college courses that are available to them through CTE program. In STEM, we're seeking investment of $21 million, which is an increase of $7 million from the 13-15 session, $5 million that doubles the state network of STEM hubs, $7.1 million for STEM innovation and dissemination grants, and $9 million to provide startup funding to university and community college programs in high-demand fields like health sciences, computer sciences, and analytics and engineering. So there's a couple of requests that we're making that are big difference makers for kids and what our system looks like in the long run.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you. Is there work being done? You know, our community colleges, several of them have the two-year RN program.
Mm-hmm.
But now nearly every hospital in Oregon, the entry level is a BSN. And how are we looking at that? As just one example, we were talking about STEM and healthcare. We've got situations out there where we've got two-year RNs that have been on the job in a hospital for a number of years, and now they've been given the ultimatum that you will get your BSN within a certain amount of time or you lose your job, and which probably relegates them to a nursing home or some other level of care where they can stay with a two-year RN. How are we looking at addressing that?
Representative Huffman, Mr. Chair, a few ways. I know that some of our universities are involved in helping ramp up opportunities for students to earn that bachelor's degree in nursing. We also have other providers in the state. I know Western Governors University, which is a very interesting model of competency-based education that is licensed to do business in Oregon, is filling a portion of that niche. We'd be happy to get back to you about more details, but you certainly have highlighted one of the areas of focus as we try to match sort of state investment with workforce needs. That's clearly one of the areas that pops in terms of workforce needs.
Senator Roper.
Quick comment just to coincide with what was said earlier about Tillamook High School. I believe last year they had the highest graduation rate for Hispanic students in the state, coupled with the kinds of things that they're doing around CTE and that kind of stuff. So it does affect a lot of different.
And we're going to need to wrap things up.
Okay, could I say one last thing just about, because these kiddos, we can't forget the high school equivalency. These are our students who for some reason have not gotten diplomas on time and decide they want to take another route, which is high school equivalency. We are suggesting investment in this, and really what it's about is to have a coordinated system. Now sometimes you get them at community college. There's community-based organizations that have done a great job. The new GED, as we know it, is aligned with Common Core state standards. It's a much more rigorous program. We have to provide coordination. We have to provide resources so those community-based organizations who have been successful with helping our students get GEDs. And we need to defray the cost. The cost has increased with the new program. So we think that is critical, and I just didn't want to leave those kiddos out.
And I enjoyed going to GED graduation at Mount Hood Community College every year during the years I was on the board. Those young people, some of them not real young, were so excited about getting their high school equivalency. Rob?
Co-Chairman Rowe, thank you. I just want to make sure and close out the way I've closed out actually the last 2 days. So what I haven't been able to talk about today, just because time is constrained, is the highest ROI, the highest return on investment thing that we're going to offer, period, which is age 3 to grade 3 literacy. I'll be back to talk about that when I do our agency budget starting on Monday, and you'll have your fill of me. And then I bet I will be back as you really want to dive into the details about this. It's an $85 million request, and it is the game changer for us. And so I just wanted to, not because I wanted to close with that, but because we had planned to talk about that fairly substantially in this presentation. We haven't had the opportunity. I just want to plant that we will be back and we'll be really detailed and after that one hard. Thank you.
Okay, and Mr. Wilson, TSPC tomorrow?
That is right, both the agency presentation and public testimony.
And then we'll be back with these folks on Monday. Okay, anything else?
That's all, Gracie.
We are adjourned.